Thank you everyone very much for coming along today. Actually, this is a bit of a special session we have today. It was funded by the Society for the Study of French History, and they've made this funding available to our seminar group to try and help bring more scholars across the channel to speak to us across here, and to keep the Franco-British cooperation alive, especially in turbulent times. So we're very lucky today to have Nicolas Delalonde here to speak to us. Nicolas is an associate professor at Sciences Po, recently published in 2011 Les Batailles de l'Impôt. Is this a copy you have here or something different? Okay. Recently published Les Batailles de l'Impôt, From the Revolution to Today. And also, I spoke to a colleague today at UCL, Fabrice Ben-Simon, who spoke very warmly of Nicolas and was talking about their upcoming edited volume, which they worked together on, and published with Brill, which comes out in May 2017, which is on the first international in global perspective. Nicolas is also editor-in-chief of La Vie des Idées, La Vie des Idées, the website, the political website, which is very much worth the read as well. Thank you. And so he's here to speak to us today with a paper entitled Transnational Solidarity Between French, British and European Workers at the Time of the First International in the 1860s and the 1870s. So welcome, Nicolas, and thank you.
Thank you very much for your invitation. Thank you very much for coming tonight. I'm really glad to have the opportunity to present this this work in progress. When Ian contacted me, I hesitated on the kind of topic of paper I should present to you. And actually, I don't really like presenting old stuff and old things, so I would present something I'm working on at the moment, so it will bring with it a lot of uncertainties, imperfections, but I think this will make the discussion really profitable for me, and I hope for us, for you as well. So I will, as a forward, give some words of contextualization of this research, and then explain the wider framing of the project I'm working on. I've been working on for 2 years. So my past and current works dealt with the question of state power and tax resistance in modern and contemporary France in the 19th and 20th century. And my PhD was entitled and published under the name, the title, Les Batailles de l'Impôt, Consentement à la Résistance, from 1789 to nowadays. And since then, I've developed works and reflections on the questions on the political history of public debt in France, in Europe, in a collective framing, other works on philanthropy, and now this piece I will present on the question of transnational solidarity between European workers. It's hard to synthesize the kind of topics I'm essentially interested in. But to sum up, I would say that one first question that I'm focusing on is the question of what is solidarity made of? And I'm especially interested in boundaries and the blurred boundaries often between taxation, charity, and philanthropy, and a third model, which is that of the market relations and the role of loans in promoting forms of solidarity. I will give some examples today. And a second question is deals with the social and political content that money relations create among people. So I do not define myself as an economic historian. I'm working on economic issues and matters, but what is of interest to me is the social, political, and cultural dimension of this phenomenon. In the work I will be presenting today on transnational solidarity in the meetings, I am doing two significant shifts from my previous work. First, I'm looking at solidarity in other realms than the state. I'm looking at solidarity against and beyond the state, so within the First International and among especially trade unions and socialist parties in the late 19th century, and especially this attempt at globalizing labor and labor struggle to oppose global capital starting in the 1860s and 1970s. And the second move, which I'm doing, is an attempt, which is a banal one, but which I'm happy to try, about transnationalizing French history with some new reflections and approaches on some comparative and transnational dimension. And this paper, in the end, does not deal directly with French history. It relates with the question of the relations that French, British, and other European workers could have at the time. But of course, I'm doing from a French perspective. And I brought today, just to give you some information about this publication, a book that was published in January, for which I was one of the coordinators, an Histoire mondiale de la France, which has just been published in January, which is a kind of attempt and synthesis at putting French history within a transnational and global framework perspective, starting a very long time ago, since it started something like 34,000 years before Jesus Christ. But of course, you have half of the book which is devoted to the post-revolutionary period. So it is triggering some harsh debates at the moment, because of course there is a political reading of the book, and this is also an attempt at counterbalancing some very essentialist view and narrow-minded view of French history that are so powerful in France at the moment, and obviously in other countries in the public debate and public space. So if you like, just to take a look. So the research I'm working on focuses on relations between various workers. But for the purpose of this presentation, I will say more about the relations between France and Britain, even if it's not the only kind of relations I am working on in this work. So why study the first international? The conference you mentioned that was organized by Fabrice Ben-Simon, Quentin de Luarmoz, and Jeanne Moisan in Paris in 2014. Try to offer a fresh look at an old institution. You had a lot of ancient works and studies on the First International, with a lot of historical and ideological debates. Just as a reminder, of course, there was the world of the Marxist and social history until the 1970s, which was the source of many interesting works, especially for the 100 years of the First International in the early 60s. The traditional issues were focusing on some political and ideological dispute between Marxists, Proudhonians, and Baconists, or focusing mostly on some sort of ideological strife and battles. And one question was if it was possible to ask new questions and try and look at the experiment of the First International by taking into account some new historiographical perspectives. So the potential answer that I'm trying to develop is to study the First International as a proper international organization in the making, which of course was not comparable to posterior international organization, but that has to face and cope with issues and questions that are shared by states, international organization, and some civil society organization. And of course, I'm coming to the study of the First International with some of the questions I had addressed when studying the state and the legitimacy of its taxing power in the 19th and 20th century. So among the many questions that we could raise, so I list some of them: how to build a workers' organization and overcome local and national political peculiarities. So this is a traditional question. More important, how to enforce centralization or compliance without sovereign power. That was a puzzle that namely the London General Council of the First International had to think about, think upon, and try to overcome in the late 1860s. And what is of more interest for me is the question of how to build networks of trust and confidence among stranger people, among workers that try and started to get to know each other, but of course with very weak links, ties, and this context of a strong globalization of information, labor, migration, and capital in the 1860s and 1870s, there was this issue of building international networks of workers to organize and fight against what we call the globalization of capital at that time. I look specifically at money issues and questions, but not from an economic or technical perspective, but just to try and point out some important political, social, and ideological debates that could be at play within the first international, all the European sections that gathered within this organization. Among the questions that this kind of organization has to face, there is one dealing with the collection, the centralization and redistribution of resources. So this is the kind of questions I'm asking myself when working on that. The First International, and especially the General Council, wanted to compile information about the labor movement and labor migration across Europe. So this idea that they wanted to counter the statistical role played by states, by bourgeois states in that period, by being able to build proper working class statistics to oppose capital at that time. Thirdly, they wanted to coordinate strikes and resistance to lockouts, and this is a point I will develop in the paper, and create networks of trends and a sense of collective obligation. When you read the inaugural address of the First International, there is the idea that everybody is for solidarity, but solidarity is something that has to be fought for, built for patiently, and this is a matter of creating social links, social dependencies, and feeling of reciprocity in the concrete and practical activities of working class people at the time. So money is not only an economic or material effect, it's also a social, political, and intellectual issue. So we can refer, for instance, to the work of the famous sociologist Viviana Zelidze, which invites us to look at money issues as a matter of power, as an intellectual debate that was central in that year about the various role that credit, saving, and workers' autonomy should play in the organization of economic and social relations at the time. So that was, of course, this is a question central to every socialist movement or working class movement or trade unions movement at the time. There is also the question of how do you produce solidarity? So what do you call exactly and concretely solidarity? And I especially look at the concrete forms that this type of relations could take, and especially the debate about the comparative roles and merits of donations, loans, gifts, and so on. There are various possibilities of helping another worker, and what I'm interested in is in the kind of moral and social content these various forms were made of, and there are some sort of diffusing across this social network. So more generally, it is an inquiry into understanding what we could call the moral economy of the First International experiment, so above and beyond the usual and what we know about the ideological debates, looking at the practices to understand the kind of solidarity and feeling of obligation that were developed at the time. So I will present two parts for the purpose of this talk. In the first one, I guess it will be the longer one, so please do not hesitate to remind me that maybe I may be forgetting my time, so I will try to be serious, but so I will firstly focus on strikes and workout solidarity in the time of the First International, and second, give some reflections about the reconfiguration of Franco-British relations after the Commune and the end of the First International, addressing this idea that the Commune was a sort of watershed and split the relations that had been creating in the 60s, creating a brand new system of solidarity in Europe in the late 19th century. So I will go as rapidly as possible on something that on which I'm working on is that is the general organization of the First International, and especially the financial aspect and financial power and legitimacy of the General Council, and this idea that was really common at the time, that the General Council of the First International, that was based in London, would be a very powerful and strong center that could organize strikes, resistances all across Europe. So there are lots of fears, anxieties, and exaggeration at the time. And many European governments shared the belief or wanted to worry public opinions and other governments that the General Council was able, thanks to treasury, thanks to a lot of money, and people thought that the money was in England, somewhere in England. So in the documents that you can find in the archive de la Préfecture de Police, you have reports on sort of the treasuries in Birmingham. So I have a special informer that told me that he saw the balances of the First International that are really rich and very organized the global revolution. So of course, then it was used when the commune started, but we know that actually the international, the First International, played little role in the start of the commune. That was really a local-based movement, with, of course, the role played by internationalist militants and then forms of solidarities, connections that were organized by the General Council and other sections of the First International at the time. But in practice, that was a much more prosaic and fragile institution, and the central organization, when you look at the minutes of the General Council, was always very worried about the disastrous situation of its finance and its inability to make local sections from various countries pay and contribute to the organization. So you had a good members, the English one, they were accustomed to pay high contributions. They could pay this contribution to their local, firstly to their, of course, local and trade organization, and give some extra contribution to the General Council. And there was a lot of debate and discussions about the amount of this contribution, and in many cases, because Marx and others were really interested in attracting English workers, they could negotiate and say, okay, we will give you a sort of a refund or a limitation of your contribution so that we gather and try and attract many English workers. But many tensions appeared within the General Council on this question of the indebtedness of the organization, and especially the English trade unionists who were part of the General Council, thought that to be a solid and rigorous and serious organization, you couldn't be in debt. It was impossible to have this really financial mess. It's only, for instance, in 1870 that a financial committee was created to try to organize the books and the balance sheets of the institutions. And this is part of the research, but actually they didn't have any idea of how they could really, they didn't know how much contribution they were receiving, how much they ought to receive, and the question of the spending was, of course, also very controversial. But promoting beliefs and myths about the strength of the institution was shared at the same time by governments and by members of the General Council and other people dealing with the organization. So here I quote two famous people that were part of the General Council. Ekarius, which has a worker from German origins living in London, which states in some minutes of the General Council, the worst thing we can do is to tell the public and the governments that we are poor. So in your public declarations, when you issue addresses to support French workers' strikes or German workers' strikes, you have to show that you are strong and that all the money will come from various places in Europe to support this. But it did not work like that, but of course they were perfectly aware of that, but thought that it was important to play on the rhetorical aspect of it to try to build the legitimacy and the reputation of the institution. And Marx said the same year, it is preferable not to reveal the true strength of the movement because the public thinks that the active members are far more numerous than they really are. Of course, the question of finance was directly related to the number of people adhering to the institution. So there have been long debates about how many workers were really part of the institutions. It doesn't really make sense because, of course, you had a lot of collective unions for adhering, but actually not really contributing to these stations. For an English trade unionist at the time, if you adhere but that you don't pay, you are not really a member because you are not really helping or fostering the organization in its self-organization. So finance was a source of tensions and weaknesses. There are lots of financial mismanagement, and it creates relations of distrust and conflicts in London, but all over Europe, because, for instance, when the General Council would send money to Belgium to help this strike, the money could be lost. You had to resort to some sort of intermediaries or brokers that would cross the channel. But there are lots of spies at the time, and that was really the beginning of this relations and connections between workers that were sharing this idea of solidarity, but often did not really know each other. So you had this question of reputation. Am I sure that you are really a member of this organization in Belgium? Was something that only some strong organization could have really solved at that time. And that was, reducing this uncertainty of the financial management of the institution, as for other institutions, was crucial because, of course, a lot of workers would hesitate doing and contributing in face of various scandals, or you read in the press that there were so many contributions collected and sent to finance this strike in Basel and Geneva or not, but the money did not really arrive. So, of course, that it was not always about dishonesty or forgery or crooks, but the organization was, of course, really complex within a framework of political control, repression, especially on the continent, less in Britain at the time. Two opposite approaches were debated within the General Council, but also across various sections. That was a transversal question. The opposition on the one hand on this idea that a workers' movement, a social movement, had to be managed and directed by the workers themselves, even if they are not specialized in budget finance management and so on. And on the other hand, the idea that you had to have a strong and qualified people. And for instance, that was a debate that the General Council had, and Marx and Engels justified the fact that you had to resort to some merchants people so that the finance could be managed properly. And of course, this is a long opposition between the idea of a sort of a spontaneous organization, sometimes without a strong economic or financial competencies. But from the English side, or even on the continent, you will have the development of this idea that you have a proper workers' knowledge about how you manage and direct a cooperative, a trade unions, a benefit society, and so on. So this question of the economic and social competencies of the militant workers was important. Money, and this is something that is quite known, was a real power issue within the First International, and was part of the struggle and conflict between Marx, Bakunin, and others. There was the ideological debate on the question of centralization and federalization, but also a conflict about the control of resources, and especially the ability or not of the General Council to pool resources to organize something larger on the European continent. The 1860s were marked by a very important huge wave of strikes, especially after 1864 in Britain, France, Belgium, Switzerland, Germany as well, and in many countries at that time. So few countries had proper trade unions. Of course, Britain was an exception at the time. But for instance, in France, the droite coalition was was authorized in 1864. In Germany, some years later, and there was a boom in strikes, especially at the beginning within skilled workers, and later in the 70s, 80s, and later among unskilled workers. The members of the First International had mixed feelings about strikes, their legitimacy and their usefulness. That was something that was debated in their conferences, especially in Geneva, Basel and Brussels in the late 60s. On the one hand, strikes were a means to attract new members and strengthen the role of the International as an international platform for mobilization. Of course, that was an argument that was attractive to workers, that to know that if they go on strike, they could receive the help of some other European workers through this organization, and it was a source and a cause of some adhesion to the international in those years. For instance, in Lyon in 1869, at the grève des Ovalistes, women workers going on strike, and they choose to become member of the international because they knew that it could foster and widen the public that could be aware of their mobilization and try to help them morally and financially. But on the other hand, it was a restriction to the aim of the organization, which was not thought to promote local labor conflict, but think on a more universal scale, and there was also some. I'm not going into details. Strong opposition between, for instance, the condemnation of strike by Proudhonian militants in 66 and 67, and of course the defense by English unionists of the usefulness of strikes. But we've decided that the stronger your union, the lesser the number, less strikes you will have. The idea was you have to be strong and organized to win strikes, but the idea is not to multiply strikes, but then that you will be in a better position to negotiate with employers because of your financial and organization. So the London General Council was being informed of all this movement, and of course it was also mediated in all the newspapers that were created in each national and local sections. It tried to centralize information about strikes and lockouts, and so when you read the minutes of the General Council, you are just touring Europe and seeing all these movements developing week after week, and sometimes developing too much in the minds of the General Council and others, saying that they were not promoting this idea of a general wave of strife, but rather to organize things and avoid the failure of strikes. They published numerous calls to solidarity to sustain workers' mobilizations, but it could have a reverse effect if you multiply the support address, but that it does not correspond to a material or financial support. It could, in a way, weaken the institutions. And Marx was really aware of that. He said that the General Council should avoid sending only once, and of course the question of his ability to send also money and material support to the strikes was really critical for its legitimacy and power. But in the end, the General Council did not fund them the strike directly. That was many European workers thought that there was some money in London to finance strike, but actually it was rather a platform that could organize the relations between strikers and the organization that had a lot the most money at the time, that is the English trade unions at that time. So London was a financial platform for French and European workers, and it's true that in the second half of the 1860s, there are lots of connections between French workers and English trade unions, starting even before the creation of the First International. This is part of the story and mythology of the International, because it was the first context were taken when a delegation of French workers traveled to London for the International Universal Exhibition of 1862 with the support of Napoleon III, and that was the first context taken by Tolin and others, which then gave way to the creation of the First International in September 1864. The English trade unions were a model and lender for continental workers, and it became usual to go to London, to do the London trip, to try and ask for money, because there was a really huge discrepancy between the organization that the English unions had built since the 1820s, with the authorization of them and the creation of their unions. And of course, the fact that in many European and continental countries at that time, you had only a proto-organization with a few possibilities to gather and collect money. So I will give some examples later. The General Council served as a go-between for European delegates. So as I said, you couldn't knock on the door of the General Council and receive money, but the General Council will tell you where you should go in London to try and address the various corporations or council, trade council, to try and defend your case and call for solidarity. But very soon, in the late 60s, it appeared that the English trade unions weren't able to finance all strikes in Europe. So the situation became really critical in 69 and 70, where each week you had demands for help and assistance. And in the end, English unions and the General Council said, "We cannot help you, stop. Believing that we have a lot of money." So what is interesting for me is that London was at the time, of course, the capital of capital for all the states that could borrow money there, but also the capital of some sort of those who were combating or fighting against capital to try to organize solidarity among European workers. The organization of money flows raised a lot of practical and social issues and difficulties. The first, which is very prosaic, but which was not easy to solve in those years, was how to perform money transfer with so much police surveillance, and how do you transfer money. So in the 60s, it's mostly cash transfers. So you have to travel with the money, so you have to find the people. It will change 20 and 30 years later, where you will have a strong organization, strong unions using some financial institutions to do the transfer. There was the question of how do you equilibrate the financial relations. So the English unions were ready to lend money, sometimes to give money, but of course the idea and the necessity of the reciprocity of the relation was raised, and this is of course a sort of anachronism, but the discussion of we want our money back was raised very soon by the English trade unions in those years. And one other important question, but I won't really develop it, because it was part of the debate on the Marx-Bakunin controversy at the time, was about the ability of the General Council to supervise, monitor, and redirect the money flows across Europe. Some ideas according to which the General Council and Marx and others would have been pleased so that the General Council could organize some form of transfer of money across Europe, depending on the place where the strikes were happening. So what was really for me a surprise, but maybe it is known to you, was that in those years and later in the 19th century, still in the early 20th century, most of the money transfer were not subscriptions or donations, but loans. You had various forms of sending money and expressing your solidarity financially. And this idea that especially the free credit, le crédit gratuit, which was a Proudhonian term, some sort of Proudhonian utopia developed since the revolution of 1848, was some sort of practical relation that various workers' organizations or localizations had in those years. So lending money to distant workers without any interest, but with the expectation that it would foster solidarity and in the end create some reciprocity. You help the other with the idea that they will often help you the day you will go on strike and have a labor or a conflict with employers or not. So why was were loans deemed preferable to donations? And this is really clear in many texts, and I do not quote here, but it's really important. First, loans created a relations between equals. It creates created interdependence between equals, and workers were all defending their sense of autonomy. So I don't want just to be helped by you from a philanthropic perspective. I wanted to break with the trends of philanthropy that were really developing in the 19th century. But we are equals, and we can build economic relations and solidarity relations within which we do not suffer from the inequality of the relation between the one who gives and the one who receives. Second, it would foster individual responsibility, and that was clear in the minds of English unions. I lend you money, but this is an incitation, incentive for you to organize properly, publish transparent accounts of your strike, and I want you to really prove me that you are organizing yourself, importing or imitating in a way the English model of building unions, and this is the conditions for me to lend you money. And then thirdly, there was also the idea that when you lend money, it will create some sort of a chain of reciprocity. I lend to you, and then this is an incentive for you to lend to other people, for instance, on the continent. I will give some examples later in just a moment. On the contrary, donations, gifts, were common practices. It was not exclusive. In many occasions, when you decided to help or support a workers' movement, you could create two types of subscriptions, gift subscriptions, a gift list, and a loan subscription. So with two different meaning and consequences for the relationship was created. Donations were seen as a sign of moral and political inferiority. So, for instance, the General Council on over sections of the First International would send money to help some Belgian miners of, for example, for Marchien, of Marchien in 1867, who were harshly repressed by the army. So, of course, that was a case for some sort of sentiment d'humanité. So, I will help you just as in a philanthropic move, but at the same time, in all the texts that were sent to the Belgian, it was precise that we help you, but we think that you shouldn't have organized like that, or you shouldn't have launched this anarchistic movement and provoke the violence of the army. And this is a sign of inferiority. You should change your organization. Second, you had also aids and helps sent for the victims of political persecutions or armed violence. And of course, there was this kind of relations for political purposes within the First International. For instance, when German socialist leaders were arrested in 1871 for the Paris Commune and so on, I will give some examples. So when a strike broke up on the continent, you had to travel to London to try and find support, and the most important institution wasn't really the General Council of the First International, but the London Trades Council that had been created in 1860. And that was really the gatekeeper, so the meeting of all the trades of the London area, that could grant you a credential with which you could then go and see all the trades of London, the bricklayer operatives, the masons, the building trades, and so on, and say, okay, so we have been, we have applied in a way to the London Trade Council, and they judge that our cause is a good one. We are properly organized. We know what we are doing. So please help us. And there is this form of so support that is given by the central organization. These relations existed even before the creation of the First International. So I looked in the archives and minutes of the London Trades Council, and already in, for instance, in July 1864, you had a delegation of Limoges workers, porcelain workers, who came to London and were so received by the London Trades Council and could present their cause. So here I quote George Howell, the secretary of the London Trades Council. So the secretary considered that there was a point that should not be lost in sight in connection with this appeal. He recollected that during builder strikes of 1860, the Paris workmen, without being appealed to, sent the sum of £5 18 shillings toward the support of the strike. Those, this point to this idea that there was a memory of the heads and relations that had been developed earlier, which was an argument to continue on having these financial relations. As I mentioned earlier, you had to find some sort of independent authorities to organize your subscription. For instance, for that occasion, that was Villeblanc, the famous Republican, that was named treasurer for all subscriptions, so he didn't really play a concrete role, but his name could reassure people, so it's not, so you had to find some people giving authority, reputation, respectability to the subscription you were creating. But interestingly, there were also a lot of misunderstanding between the Limoges workers and other European workers arriving in London and their English counterparts. And for instance, in that case, so the Limoges porcelain workers could receive some money, but there was a misunderstanding on the nature of the money that was sent. Was it a gift? Was it a donation or was it a loan? And later, the guy from the French delegation, Talandier, wrote to George Hodger. So that was my mistake. Hodger was the secretary of the London Trade Council at that time and a member later of the General Council of the First International. You know, 10 days later, someone has been spreading a report that all funds subscribed by your trade societies were to be considered as a loan advanced to the men on strike. I know well that this is not the case and cannot be mined by such a report, but as over maybe, I must beg you to give this libel the answer it deserves. So there could be some misunderstanding on the very nature of the practice of the loan when people were coming to London to ask for money. The most famous case is the the call that the Parisian bronze workers addressed to English and London societies in April 1867. This is a major event in the story of the First International, and a case of direct relations and direct aid, help, financial help from the English unions to the Parisian bronze workers, and which helped them to win the labor conflict they had with their employers at that time. So here is the French translation of the appeal that was sent by the London Trades Council. But interestingly, of course, then there was the answer, and the letter of remerciement sent by the Parisian bronze workers, stating that it created for them a sense of moral indebtedness, of course, but also financial indebtedness. So they didn't pledge to reimburse immediately the money that had been sent, but with the idea that the day it would be useful, they would, of course, help reciprocally their British counterparts, even if actually, of course, if you compare the financial strength of the two sides of the channels, the help that the French workers could bring to English workers were more symbolic in that case than in the world. So that was an asymmetric relations in the sense that for French workers or Swiss workers or Belgian workers, the money they could receive from abroad was really important in their strife or conflict, which was not really the case for the British. But what were the expectations of British English unions when they send or lend money to European continental workers? First, they wanted and they expect this money to invite European workers to avoid and limit the movement, the migration movement that could be something that was weakening social movements in London. Of course, they wanted to fight against the phenomenon of blacklegs, the importation of foreign labor. And when they were sending money, they were also sending addresses saying if an employer comes in Belgium or in France to say there is work to be done in London, be aware that we are on strike. So this is the reciprocity. We are not expecting money from you, but we are expecting from you that you stop the migration flows that could be fragilization of working class struggles in Britain. Secondly, they wanted to also invite European workers to get organized, imitate the model, and fight strongly, properly for a rise in wages and labor conditions. And there was this idea that if you promote the standardization of wage and labor conditions, it will curb and limit this process of foreign migrants coming to London or other places and break the strikes or movements that were developing. And of course, they wanted to generalize the British union practices. When you look at the various debates during the conferences of the First International, there was, of course, that you are struck by the fact that there are some debates involving some opposition between Marxism, Bakuninism, and so on. But a lot of the time, we were discussing about the generalization of the caisse de résistance, really the types of practices that were typical of English trade unions at the time. So, of course, it was source of misunderstanding also within the First International. So a lot of European workers were part of the First International without ever read one line of Marx or others. Of course, the addresses of the First International were, for most of them, written by Marx, but the first volume of The Capital was published in 1867. The militants were aware of that. They were discussing about the translation, but I mean for the grassroots mobilization, it was not the really most important issue when we were joining the First International. Money flows would create also so the sense of reciprocity and I mentioned, and a form of also multi-directional solidarity on the continent. For instance, when the bronze workers received aid and help from Britain, then it encouraged them to lend money as well to other workers in France, in Switzerland, or elsewhere. So it was, they were not paying back to Britain. But when you read carefully the press in France, Germany, Belgium, abroad, you see how a movement that has received the help then will try and reciprocate the kind of relation they could benefit from during their armed strikes. But there was a lot of misunderstandings. These relations could suffer from a lack of financial transparency in France and European, other European countries. No, for the English unionists, it was a cause of conflict, and it may cause them to stop helping, because they wanted, for them, when you go on strike, you need to publish in the end a strike balance, a strike account with all the details and financial details. And most of the time, the French unions and other could, in some cases, do that. But most of the time, it's really hard to find proper information on that. There was no reimbursement, and I don't think the English unions were really expecting that. But I mean, when the balance was too much unbalanced, I'm sorry for the petition, they stopped paying and saying, okay, we stop helping people from the continent because we have no information about what they are doing of our money, and we have no hope of receiving something. And of course, also, there are too many demands sent to London. So the reputation of the financial, the English unions was too strong, and then couldn't answer and select the right cause. So what I will just sum up the last part in 2 or 3 minutes. I'm sorry for the way I'm managing the time. What became of these relations after the Commune and the end of the First International? Most of the time, when you read the literature, there is this idea of there was a special moment in the late 60s and early 70s with these strong Franco-British relations. Other countries were really involved, so I'm not developing the other cases of Belgium was really central to this story, and Belgium was even much closer to England. And for instance, in the case of the blacklegs migration, one of the real important issue for English unionists was the import of Belgian workers and Belgian Dutch also. But these relations between France, French and British workers were of course really affected by the Commune and the disappearance, the progressive disappearance of the First International in the 1870s. First of all, solidarity, worker solidarity was pushed to the test when many communard refugees arrived in London. Others were fled to Brussels, Geneva, some to the US, some were deported. And when a lot of French communards arrived in London, they had read all these discourses, addresses on workers' solidarity. So we have fought this giant struggle in Paris. It had a universal echo. We arrive in London, of course, we will be welcomed and receive the help of our fellow English workers. And it's true that England was some sort of a haven for there, because, for instance, the British government and the civil society as well didn't respond to the call of the French government to expel the refugees and stick to their tradition of asylum. And lots of them could install in London and other places. But when they arrived, the French workers, the French communards, thought that they could receive an help, a financial aid and subsistence from their English counterparts. It worked and existed for some weeks in the summer of 1870, but soon it stopped because, of course, it was really hard to collect enough money, so there was very source of collecting money at the time to try to finance the refugees. But most of all, the English donors, English unions, and over soon became skeptical about the communards' attitudes. There were political tensions, and a lot of the English unions didn't share, for instance, the stance that Marx and others took in favor of the commune. So that was a case of separation and split, and many English unionists just quit the General Council because they saw their name on the address published by the General Council, but did not really adhere to this idea that they were supporting the commune. But most of all, there was a lot of anger about the attitude of the French refugees, with the idea that they were just expecting to receive aid and assistance, but not trying to find work, to find ways to have a proper living. So, I quote from one among many other excerpts we could quote, taken from the archives de la préfecture de police. Mr. Robinson, Richardson et la plupart des membres du comité anglais commencent à se fatiguer de la charge des réfugiés et de la constatation du grand nombre qui reste sans travail, bien qu'ils aient une profession. Monsieur Robinson a déclaré avant-hier qu'il était loin de se douter que ce parti pût compter un aussi grand nombre de fainéants, de propres ariens et de chevaliers d'industrie. Si c'était à recommencer, je crois bien que je ne ferais rien pour eux. Donc, lot of disillusion from both sides, and the idea developed within the communard refugee community that the English workers refused to help them, but on the other side, the idea that the communards are all dangerous, either anarchists, fainéants, crooks, and so on. You have lots of examples in the literature. But beyond that, of course, what I'm interested in is the fact that you have had enduring relations beyond the commune and beyond the demise of the First International. Maybe I will try and sum up and conclude with this example and give some words of conclusion. I'm interested in some figures that were these workers that perpetuated the relations between English and French workers after the First International. So Zéphirin Camilina, a bronze worker, a French Parisian bronze worker, is a good example. He was a member of the First International from the very beginning, coming from a sort of what we could say a Proudhonian background. He signed the famous Manifeste des 60 in 1864, was at the beginning against the principle of strike. So in 1866, at the Geneva Conference of the First International, he was one among the other French members who were skeptical about the use of strike. But in 1867, he was one of the members of the delegation sent to raise money among the to the London Trades Council and among the English unions. He was head of La Monnaie, the mint under the Commune, and then a refugee in London, where he takes part in British trade unions and worked in his trade as a bronze worker in the 1870s. And when he comes back to France after the amnesty, he's a leader of the bronze trade in Paris, in France, and a key player of international socialist and trade union relations. Of course, there was the perpetuation of these relations. He developed other relations when going to various universal exhibitions, for instance, in Boston in 1884, and he developed contacts with American unions. And he had lasting relations with British trade unions, and you can find some evidence in his personal archives that are held at the Bobigny Archives Départementales. And then he was, in the early 20th century, treasurer of the SFEO and played a role within the International Socialist Bureau and had these international connections. But this is only one example where you find, you see how the experiment of the first international and then the experiments of the communards refuge and exile in the 70s developed and entertained these relations between some of these figures. And when you look, and I will end with it, carefully at some of the minutes, for instance, of the London Trains Cartel, you see that these practices of giving or lending money to a continental worker continued even after the First International, but that was not really related to the experiment of the First International, which tried to generalize it, but it was created before and lasted long after. You had contacts and support for various causes, the textile workers, porcelain workers, again in Limoges in 1883, the Casville strike in the 1880s. But for instance, when you had some delegations who would come several times when you look in the minutes, for instance, the Calais lace makers, and there was relations, strong relations between the Calais lace makers, because the lace industry had been created by lots of English workers previously, were helped by the London Trade Council in 1890, or even in during a great strike in the very end of the 19th century, and with help given directly by the London Trade Union, Congress, Parliament Committee, and other organizations. And so I don't have time to really develop, but these connections were really important in the late 19th century and early 20th century. But to conclude, there was a change in the geography of these relations, because if the Franco-British connection had been really important in the 1860s, when you look 30 years later in the 1890s and early 20th century, the two social movements, workers' movement, the English and the French ones, got marginalized, because this kind of relations of financial assistance, help, loans and donations was much more important between German trade unions, who get really organized in the 1890s after the repeal of the anti-socialist law, Scandinavian Union, and the paradox situation is that you had the perpetuation and expansion of this relation of transnational solidarity among workers' people, but without main actors that had been part and parcel of developing them in the 1860s, because for opposite reasons, the French unions were marginalized because they had a lack of organization, financial weakness, and were marked by their radical ideology that could align over a movement. But on the other side, the British unions, because of their feeling of superiority, ceased to help the other movements, and of course were really afraid of social democracy, not speaking about French socialism at the time, because for them, of course, the connection between unionism and socialism was not so direct, obvious or evident than it was, for instance, developed in Germany, Sweden, or Denmark, or even Belgium, in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So I'm really sorry for the length of my presentation, and I hope I was clear enough to allow you to understand what I'm trying to do, and ask me some, I hope, some really important questions. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Nicolas. Thank you very much. I think that was a really interesting paper, and lots of really interesting points in it, which I think suggest kind of synergies with other topics, isn't it? With other periods, not just with the kind of fantasy echo, but into kind of other moments as well. Obviously, that kind of framework of socialism is something which is really interesting. I mean, does anybody have a question they'd like to ask straight off the bat, or
Ian? Yeah, I've got a couple. First of all, thank you. I thought it was a really fascinating paper. I think, like most people sort of who don't work on this topic, I'm familiar with the kind of broad outlines of the ideological debate, but I have no idea about kind of the actual functioning of the organisation. So it was really interesting to hear that in such a clear and detailed way. I had sort of two questions, one that's quite specific and one that's kind of bigger picture, which I might not formulate as well as possibly I could. The more specific one has to do with the issue of, I suppose, the politicisation of these misunderstandings over kind of where the money's going to. And could you talk about this in terms of, kind of relations within the organisation and tensions arising from these kinds of things? Mutual misunderstanding about whether it's a lending or a donation, or not knowing where the money's gone. And I wondered whether, in terms of thinking about how people outside the movement understood it and presented it at the time, was this kind of issue something that was publicised quite a lot in the press, for instance, that's non-affiliated with the movement, as a means of trying to discredit it? Don't join this organisation, it's a scam, you'll never see, that kind of thing. That's my kind of specific question. My more general sort of bigger picture question has to do with how these two historiographies might map onto each other. So there's the very well-established stuff on the ideological debates, which we know about. And then this is kind of quite a radical departure from that. But I wondered to what extent debates over financial management map onto the more familiar ideological debates that we're aware of, or whether a better way of understanding these kinds of arguments is not to do with kind of ideological disagreements between Marxists and unions, but is to do with different working class cultures, I suppose. And so this issue I was really interested to hear about, for instance, loans, because that is, it's not a topic that I know a lot about from my own research, but I think the thing that I've kind of touched on a bit is the Workers' International Relief Organization from the interwar period that was linked to the Third International, and that was all about charity. And so I wonder whether, to take that as an example, to what extent the disagreements about this, is it possible to map them neatly onto the ideological disputes that we're all familiar with, or not? And if not, is it more to do with things like national working class cultures? I suppose that sort of makes sense.
Okay. Thank you very much for this really relevant questions. On the first one, on the politicization of these affairs of mismanagement or scandals, or where is the money going, it was clearly at the same time a matter of internal organizations. And when I'm reading a lot of the correspondence of these people, and they speak about money in each letter, and that they speak of other things, but this. The question of organizations that were trying to create something, so they're always in need of money to publish journals, to organize strikes. The journals were really important because you had some spreading of the information, but also you would publish, for example, the amounts of money collected for strikes or other activities. So it was an internal problem, but the external dimensions were central. And this idea of the credibility of the movement was something really crucial for, especially for the English unions, because at the time, in 1868, there was a Royal Commission of Inquiry on the organization of British trade unions, and especially on the way they were managing their finances. And what they wanted to do was to present books, balance sheets that could clearly compete with private companies' balance sheets, books, and so on. They wanted to prove that they could manage their affairs as properly as businessmen could do. And for them, it was really the source of their pride, of strength, and they didn't want to be attacked of any mismanagement or so on. And they wanted to try and spread this way of organizing oneself to other European trade unions or working class movements. And of course, many governments were using, and you had many pamphlets published telling workers that it was only a band of crooks, and they would use all the episodes they could to try to discredit the movement. So 2 weeks ago, I was in Belgium to read some various pamphlets and so on. So, for instance, one of them was an invented discussion between a grassroots worker and a priest and a member of the First International. And they were all discussing about, you will only lose your money, it's only theft organized by people interested in bad people. And so really the convincing the people that you could have faith in the organization in the local section. And this idea of the transparency and the publicity of your action, of your financial organization, was central in this process of building. So this was really crucial. And then when you take the refugee, the commune discussion in in the 1870s, the communard would had so many conflicts, accusations about this guy who enriched himself under the commune because he still such thing or something. So within the refugee community, but also of course from the anti-communards and all the literature and pamphlets that were published, this idea that it was a movement in between anarchism, radical revolution, and just a matter of theft and crooks and so on. So that was crucial really for the workers, for the workers to get credit and be recognized as a proper economic and political agents at the time. On the second question, I did not really develop, but for me this is really the most interesting methodological and historiographical stake in this research. I do not want to oppose, on the one hand, ideological disputes, and on the other hand, the reality of practices or social relations. What I'd like to do is to identify, see, and work on ideological in context and in this practical situation, to see how just they were always trying to go from the ideological realm to the practical one with various kind of circulations in their practice. If I take Camelina, for instance, the one I just briefly mentioned, in 1866, so he developed Proudhonian ideas. I'm against strike because strike, it's not in the Proudhonian theory, it's not useful for the working class, and so what we have to build is an autonomous organization. We don't have to expect many things from strikes. But then, when he was involved in the Parisian bronze worker organizations, and when the strike of 1867 started, of course, he changed his mind, and then with the frequentation of English trade unions, he would also develop another conception and another practice of the legitimacy or usefulness of strikes. So this is only one example, but I don't think there is a direct superposition between ideological battles and the practices. But I'm interested in the complex and multifaceted interactions and relations between the two realms. And then from a diachronic perspective, I think the practices of loan and this idea of the reciprocity that can be created through loans is really something that existed in many countries. This idea of the autonomy of the working class. And the loan as a way of promoting solidarity and reciprocity before the First World War. And I, I should you know, go further in the inquiry, but last week I read a full book presenting the activities of the Workers' International Relief Solidarity, and the language, the modes of actions completely changed in the 20s. They don't speak about loans anymore. They use the language of charity and philanthropy. And when you so this is a philanthropic organization. So this is, for me, this is really important because before the first law, they in a way they at the same time they separate the different domains. For instance, they will send donations for industrial catastrophes, mm-hmm. Courier in the 1906. There's a lot of money sent from Wood, so this is a natural disaster. And the working movement was in. But they would clearly separate it from political assistance to the Russian Revolution in 1905 and to assistance in time of strike. And the various situations were separated. And the financial tools they will use came from various traditions. But in the interwar period and later, that is the reason why I was surprised when I discovered this practices of loan, because of course for me they would only practice donations just as a philanthropic movement. But from an ideological perspective, donation can be justified, but it is inferior to the practice of loan, because loan was clearly, and this is not only an English practice, and the German in the late 19th century will also develop that, but in the end they developed this loan relations but with an asymmetric relations, because in the late 19th century the amounts sent abroad by the Germans are much more important than the ones sent by English workers. They don't expect things back, but they will keep on using the language of the donations, the loans, and to clearly inherit it from the period of the First International and the 60s and 70s.
Thank you. Other questions? Dan?
Yeah, thanks for a really, really interesting talk. My question is, are these kinds of issues to do with finances something that's inherent to the nature of left-wing organisations? Mm. Because there's always this kind of tension that, on the one hand, you know, left-wing organisations and publications, they're always strapped for cash. So you know, even today, it sometimes seems that the more left-wing the organisation, the more they want your money. Yet, on the other hand, of course, you know, they're anti-capitalists. They think that money is grubby. So does that make them kind of peculiarly open to the charge of hypocrisy whenever there are kind of financial... irregularities.
It creates the type of debates, tensions, and misunderstandings I mentioned during the talk. And one example that I found interesting when reading, for instance, the minutes of the General Council, was that very prosaic question of how much should the secretary be paid? Mm-hmm. Do you need somebody that you have to pay for the organization? And there is a very interesting debate in the General Council. We've underwent some that say that we are all benevolent workers. We are militants. We are doing that. We have our own jobs. But politics about engaging and so on. And Marx and others saying that, no, we need professionals. And you need to pay for a professional. So you need to have somebody that can exchange correspondence in various languages, that has a lot of networks, that knows how to manage finance, publish addresses, many tactical skills. Mm-hmm. And they have, and so in the General Council, they had this discussion because they were in such a financial mess that they wanted to cut on the expenses. And you have the English unionists saying, okay, no, we don't need to pay so much the secretary. We just... Icarus used to be, so it was a German exile workers was for a moment the secretary. And they say we just need competent people, but benevolent people. But then you will find this kind of questions in all local sections, and then on, in national union organization of political parties at the time. So it creates tensions because they, of course, they want to fight capital, but they want to be as much respectable as capitalist. And they don't want to be attacked of doing, you know, doing n'importe quoi with the workers' money. So they want to prove that they can spare money. For instance, they attack in the 60s. They attack the role of saving banks. So they say the workers should stop putting their money in saving banks. We should share, pool our resources. We don't need the capitalist institutions or institutions created by capitalists to get interest from our own money. But of course, you have to demonstrate the workers that you can manage their money in a decent way. And then this is clearly an opposition between in the late 19th century between. For instance, German trade unions and French trade unions. For the French, you know, they promote the idea of the grève générale, general strike, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. They want the Second International to recognize the need of launching the... But the other said, you are not ready for that. We Germans, we English, but we Germans, they say, we know how much it costs to launch a strike, to win a strike. And we know that you are not ready to do that. And so, but the French say, no, it's about, we need revolution now. Mm. The others say, revolution will take time because you need to get organized and so on. So then you have the meddling of ideology with the kind of professional abilities or competences. And in the early 20th century, I'm interested in the first international organization of trade unions. There are international organizations by trades and métiers, but there was a secretary that was created and dominated by the German unions, and they really insisted on the necessity to publish statistics, balance sheets, having the proper time kind of documents that could just show how serious and professional the organization was before envisioning mass or huge actions.
Do you think that the increasing primacy of mass political parties within the international movement late, like in the second and then third international, sort of explains some of this as well?
But I mean, starting in the 60s, you had the same opposition between the amount of people who took part in British unions and European sections. But of course, in the late 19th and early 20th century, the number of people involved completely changed. In Germany, you have 2 million people who take part in various trade unions, which is much more than in Britain at the time, so that may also explain the changing position, and there is this idea that yes, you need to build your mass organization, build some sort of also of counter society. So this is because the unions and the party offers education, various services. But I didn't mention that. But then there is the question on what kind of services the unions should offer and propose. It is really important for strikes, support funds, but then you have all the benefits that can be for insurance, for sickness, accidents, and so on, that could be brought by the unions in exchange of high contributions. And the Germans take the British model in the late 19th century and expand it in other dimensions at that time.
I just wanted to add just one thing, just a comment, because you mentioned bonds. It reminded me of a speaker that we had a few weeks ago, Alex SEA
units. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you're aware of that?
We are working together in the collective work I'm coordinating on the global and political history of public debts. So So I had some opportunities to discuss, not this paper, but some other parts of my research.
On that issue, on the idea of the kind of the global histories, and of course you talked about the idea of the Histoire mondiale, and at the end you finished by talking about new international geographies. And of course we're talking about a period which is the period of high imperialism, a period of massive imperial expansion. Of course, not necessarily in France or Britain, but you look somewhere like in Spain, in Catalonia, something like the Semana Tragica, which is, you know, a huge kind of workers' uprising, really spurred on by the kind of burden of imperialism. And I wondered if that kind of mass imperial expansion in the 1880s, 1890s, changes that geography. If rather than just being about kind of local and particular struggles, it actually expands that horizon further, gobbles up in a way that mass political participation also does. I wonder if that has a kind of distortive effect on the ability to offer solidarity, to solidarize across that kind of transnational border.
I did not find any example of financial solidarity towards colonized people before the 20s.
Sure,
and
sure.
This is really different than the international workers' relief organization. Adopt the anti-imperialist stance, but also in the over-organization of the free unions, international free trade unions organizations. They also they will bring some help to Indian workers in the 20s and other cases. And strangely, before the First World War, you have some. I don't find this kind of relations directly. But there is a change in the geography in the 80s with, of course, the role of American trade unions.
Mm-hmm.
So for Britain, it changes some the relations. But and for Britain, the close connection with Australian, New Zealand, starting in the 80s and 90s. So with white workers, mainly from Australia, and one example. I wanted to give was the example of the London docker strikes in 1889, where you see that if you compare the share of money received from the what they call the colonial realm and foreign money, of course it's clearly unbalanced. You have something like £40,000 coming from the colonies, but what they call the colonies, the help given by Australian dockers, essentially, and. I mean, maybe you know that better than me, but in all the accounts you have of the squad, they say that the squad was very long, thousands of workers on Sky with their families, and it costed very, very much for 2 or 3 months in London.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the end, they're on the verge of being defeated, and you had this massive help coming from Australia. So £30,000 that was a sign addressed to the employers. Okay, we have the means to sustain the strike, because what they mean by that is to have a strike pay for the workers that are out of work, for their families, and so they organize. This is the economy of strike, and they will think about how do you, what is the economics of strike at that time. And so when you compare, and you have only 108 pounds coming from European continent. So it's clearly, in terms of the intensity of financial relations, for Britain, the continent is not so much important, and the help given by, in this case, Australia is crucial. And then the year later, in 1890, the Australian dockers went on strike, and the British workers want to give them the reciprocity and send them money. And then there is a classical problem in this long-distance solidarity movement. The time that they collect the money and try to send it, the strike is over in Australia. And so they receive the telegram. The strike is over. Keep your money. The British say, no, we still want to help you. So we send you a donation for your family and so on. They lost the strike. And the Australian answer, so we don't need your donation. Keep your money. We don't, and this is something classical for what they call at the time the aristocracy of the working class. Mm-hmm. They don't want to receive donation. And this is true also for cigar workers. There has been good research done by a Dutch scholar on solidarity relations within the cigar industry starting in the 60s. And when the cigar workers contacted the First International in the 60s, they were really reluctant to join the International. It could help them to widen the networks, so in the end they had connections, but they say we don't want donations, we want only loans. Mm. And this is this is a clear sign of difference. And then, in spite of this strong colonial relations, mostly with white workers in the colony, you have another example in the late 19th century. The Amalgamated Society of Engineers strike, a big strike in England in 1897. You have a lot of money coming from abroad. A quarter of the strike fund come from abroad, so a massive mobilization of European workers. But half of this money come from England. So you have, in this case, the role of colonial money is not so important. Mm-hmm. But starting in the late 19th century, the German unions seem to consider that it's really important that they send a lot of money, and there is also a question of occupying the sort of dominant position within the and it's also true for the Swedish general strike in 1909, where also half of the money sent from who come from the Germany, and this is the proportion I find in many examples at the beginning of the 20th century. So I see the colonial only in these cases for the moment.
Okay. Yeah.
And then you have mobilization. It will open up with Russia in 1905. So Eastern Europe is more present in this movement. And but I don't see for the moment other examples.
We're kind of running up to time just now, so do you have one last question you wanted to go, Daniel?
One more, which is, I know you said you wanted to avoid anachronism, but that you gave that kind of evocative phrase about I want my money back, a reference to Thatcher and the EU rebate. One can't help seeing certain kind of echoes of this in the period today when we've just seen the kind of massive failure of international solidarity and clearly there are echoes of some of those kinds of attitudes towards the kind of migration part of solidarity in sections of the British labour movement. So can you see kind of long-term continuities here? Is it that does all this kind of founder on the kind of traditional Anglo-French rivalry? Is there a particular reason why in that last case you gave, there is funding coming from Germany or from Sweden, but it's the Anglo-French one that's the hard one to do in terms of going up against the kinds of jingoism and xenophobia on both sides.
I don't really see continuities. The issues you are mentioning are of course really important for me, and when I look into this story, I'm always thinking about the present situations. Social competition and these things, the dynamics and the processes on this question of migration, migrant workers, standards of living, but the fundamental difference is that the level of unionization has plummeted in so many countries. So you have some exceptions, maybe in Germany, we could say, mm-hmm. but in England, France has never had a high level of unionization. For England, of course, there has been a major shift in the 1980s. But so what struck me is that finally, in the end, the level and intensity of international connections between working class militants at that period seem to have been more important than the women's, I would say. But of course, then you could try and develop some measure of that. But I think we have this long-term, long-distance relations of solidarity, which are mediated mainly through humanitarianism. So this is the main practices. But this is not so clearly related to labor issue or social conditions. But at that time, you have, of course, what I didn't mention, all the other examples of sending money to help Eastern Christians, for instance, in the Ottoman Empire, and various examples. But here, this is clearly an attempt at organizing international solidarity practically from a labor perspective. And I'm not really sure that... I think then it was really used by USSR and the Comintern. And this is where I think, in a way, it blurred the thing in the interwar period and later, because it mixed clearly social imperative and political the political spreading of communism. And after, I mean, the 70s and 80s, I don't think we can see this kind of relations and reflections, mainly because, for instance, unions do not really act or think on such a scale. So I don't know if I really answer. I'm not only focused on the Franco-British relations. The demise of these relations is not really related to some sort of relation of distrust or mistrust between the French and the British. I think this is a larger phenomenon. But this is a question I should try to address, and maybe so to give some hypothesis in the end of the world, because there is a clear a comparative dimension of this research between so what is sometimes called the first globalization and the recent wave of globalization. And clearly the missing element today is the ability of workers to unite and mobilize in this. I mean, in some organizations, there used to be unions. Mm-hmm. Clearly, you can't have the same level of. So you had ATTAC, Altermondialisme, and so on, mm-hmm. This type of organization. But did they really try and mobilize resources on the same scale? I'm not mm-hmm. really sure.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you very much. That's an interesting point to end on, that the synergies between that first and second wave of globalization. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really rich topic for research in future as well. But thank you very much for presenting this work in progress, Nicolas. So once again, ask you to say thank you to Nicolas, and also to the Society of French History for providing the funding to bring you across. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.